restricting Governor Holcomb's emergency powers, tensions in the House over discrimination concerns, plus Attorney General Rokita's second job, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending February 19th, 2021.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, the governor's authority to declare disaster emergencies would be severely restricted under legislation unanimously approved by a Senate committee. The measure, one of several this legislative session, is a reaction to executive orders issued by Governor Eric Holcomb during the COVID-19 pandemic. Republican Senator Sue Glick's bill would only allow the governor to declare a widespread emergency affecting at least 10 counties for 45 days without the General Assembly getting to weigh in. If the legislature is in session or gets called into special session by the governor, the emergency could go for 60 days. But after that, Glick says only lawmakers could extend the emergency declaration further.
So that people don't feel like they were left out or don't feel that they had any input into the orders that affected so many people.
The bill also gives the legislature more authority on how to spend federal dollars that come to the state during an emergency. How much will the legislature restrict the governor's emergency authority? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, this Senate bill goes much further than its House counterpart. Where should the General Assembly land?
They should stay out of it, frankly, Brandon. I mean, what's amazing about both of these bills is the level of Republican dissatisfaction with the very limited leadership shown by Eric Holcomb during this crisis. I mean, they're basically repudiating what he's done. And I don't feel very confident that with the anti-science caucus in the Republican Party who won't even mandate mask wearing in the chambers, that they're going to make decisions on what is a crisis and what ought to be done in the event of a crisis. I mean, I'm really shocked that they have so little faith in the governor that both sides, or the House and the Senate, are trying to undo what he's done.
Mike O'Brien, we've heard time and again during debate on these bills in both chambers from Republicans that it's not about Governor Holcomb. It's not about the decisions he's made. It's thinking about the future. Quite frankly, why should we buy that?
Well, one, I don't think, I've said this before, I don't think it's unfair that we look, that the legislature look at the emergency powers and how they're initiated and how long they can last and those things. Because we never contemplated, it was contemplated in the context of tornadoes and floods, right, mostly. It wasn't contemplated we'd be in these things for 12 to 18 months. The Senate overshot it the other direction, though, and after that 60-day window has gone by, they take it over entirely. I think the legislature deserves an advisory role in that, in a long-term emergency declaration like the one that we're in. But they took it away from the governor, and an emergency itself would indicate that you need flexibility and speed, and that is not what the legislature is good at. The legislature is intentionally slow. It's intentionally nearly impossible to get something from start to finish, the way it started to the end, and into law or into some act, and that's purposeful. So if we're going to take the emergency, the decisions that are going to be, that have to be made away from the governor entirely, after that 60-day window is foreclosed, you've given it to a body that may be incapable of making any decision in the amount of time it needs to be made. And it's not because of the makeup, it's just because of the way the system's structured and the way that branch of government was designed to operate.
John Schwannis.
It's also in part because of the makeup.
Yeah, but the makeup changes. John Schwannis,
yeah.
Is this something
not that, enough?
Is this something you think that Hoosiers want to see happen? Do they want to see the legislature assert itself more in the future when, God forbid, but if and when another emergency of this scale happens?
I think there was a time, certainly at the height of the pandemic and at the height of the restrictions that were imposed by the Holcomb administration, there was generalized frustration on the part of Hoosiers. They wanted to see somebody else who might be more lenient with those restrictions step forward and say, hey, maybe you can go to bars and restaurants. Maybe you can be a little more, caterers can maybe function a little bit more. So there was that frustration level, but I don't think that's anything that's lasting. In the heat of, you know, those things come and go along with the disasters. You know, something needed to happen probably, because if you looked at how these things stack up on a state-by-state basis, Indiana had probably at the end of the spectrum where the governor had tremendous unchecked power. Only I think Hawaii maybe had more, and they deal with tsunamis, right? So you got to have somebody and volcanoes potentially. But it wasn't necessarily that the law is written to give the governor that much authority. It's just that we have a part-time legislature, and therefore, when the legislature's not in Indianapolis, they can't do much. So what other states have done is simply have either legislative leadership weigh in the absence of the full caucus or the chambers, or have legislative council or some other subgroup. So that's another option. But I think the end result will be probably closer to the House version than the Senate version.
Nikki, that's exactly the question I wanted to ask you, which is there's a fairly big gap between what the House passed and what this passed the Senate committee. Now, we'll see if the Senate changes anything on the floor next week. But right now, which side do you see moving closer to the other?
Well, the one thing I think the Senate bill does better is it takes away the question of constitutionality on calling a special session, because it basically just says to the governor, you get this if you don't call us, you get this if you do call us. You know, there's very much confusion. The Constitution doesn't specifically say the legislature can't call itself in, but it doesn't specifically say it can either. So I think on that side, the Senate bill will win, but maybe they'll give a little bit longer options. I do want to say the legislative leaders have weighed in Indiana. We're in February, and we have not terminated that emergency.
And there was at least one resolution filed to do just that. So, all right, well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question: are Governor Holcomb's emergency powers used throughout the COVID-19 pandemic too broad? A, yes, or B, no. Last week we asked whether Indiana should eliminate the license requirement to carry a handgun in public. And in addition to this being a lopsided result, we also saw quite a spike in respondents. Just 5% say yes, 95% say no. I suspect the vote will go very differently in the Indiana House and the Indiana Senate. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, tensions flared in the Indiana House this week after Republicans shouted down Democratic lawmakers who voiced concerns about what they saw as discrimination in a bill. The legislation in question would allow a St. Joseph County township to leave the South Bend School District, which is racially diverse, for a nearby school district that's overwhelmingly white. Two black Democratic lawmakers expressed concerns on the House floor about what they viewed as discriminatory issues with it, and a group of Republicans booed and heckled them. House Speaker Todd Houston says that should not have been tolerated.
Emotions get short, and I was disappointed with today. I have to do a better job of running the floor. I'll do that, and we'll work together to make improvements.
But an ensuing argument in the hallway outside the chamber escalated. Indiana Black Legislative Caucus Chair Robin Shackelford says Republican Representative Sean Eberhardt had to be physically restrained from going after Democratic Representative Vanessa Summers.
For a member to now take it to a violent situation and look like they're going to hit a member and have to be pulled away from a member, and especially when it's a white male versus a black female, then we have some serious issues there.
Shackelford says she asked Speaker Houston last year to require all House lawmakers to undergo implicit bias training and repeated that request to him Thursday. Houston would not commit to doing so. Mike O'Brien, there are flare-ups in the General Assembly from time to time and year to year, but is this more than that?
You know, it's hard to tell. It's hard to tell what got it to that point. I think it was overblown clearly on the side of the Republicans. You still can't react that way. This isn't a closed process. I mean, they were debating this on the floor, House of the floor, or the floor of the House of Representatives. And if you're an African-American lawmaker who's experienced racism and you think you see it somewhere and you're talking about it, and if you're a Republican who believes that that's not the case or that's unfair, then you wait your turn, you get up and make your case that that's not what they were doing there, which I don't think it was. But I think you can make it, but that, there's a process for that. And we're the same party that doesn't want people tearing down statues, and mobs of people tearing down statues in the middle of the night and appeal to their government and go through the right process and do these things gradually and through the democratic processes that we've set up. And then you can't behave that way. I've never seen this. It's reflective, I guess, what's happening outside of that building too. But you've got to maintain perspective and understand that you're there to have the grown-up debate and the constructive debate, and you win or lose that, or it's characterized as a matter of perspective. And it's unfortunate what happened the other day.
And Eleni, what does the General Assembly and the House need to do to move forward in the right way?
Well, I think Robin Shackelford's idea of implicit bias training is a good one, because it's clear to me here that the reaction on the floor by the Republicans was knee-jerk. It was knee-jerk, and they were defensive. And they were defensive because they know there are some members, not all by any means, not a majority by any means, but there are some members of their caucus who are racist. I'm sorry, but that's true. And, some of the responses to that were not appropriate. But on the other hand, you can understand why tempers would run high, because this is unprecedented to start booing. I mean, it is a window to their soul. And the fact that they can't admit that and they can't react to it in a positive way, it seems to me they're going to tolerate the same kind of white supremacist nonsense that Donald Trump has been sprouting for the last, 6 or 8 years. They need to repudiate that. They need to step up and say, not just that Todd Huston needs to assert more control, but that this is unacceptable conduct and that legislators who do this should be subject to sanctions, and legislators that do the kinds of things that Bob Lucas did with his postings should be subject to severe sanctions. Because if the Republican Party wants to have diversity in its ranks and wants to be seen as supporting advancement for all, it's got to repudiate those kinds of racist knee-jerk reactions. And so far, they haven't done it.
Nikki, as I mentioned at the top of my question to Mike, we've seen arguments, shouting before, even physical disagreements between Democrats and Republicans, fellow Democrats. But you were in the chamber. Did this feel different?
I've seen some heated exchanges, but I've never seen anything in my 20 years like what I saw yesterday. So it did feel different. I think that's probably because of the last year of debate we've had on racial, matters. And so I think that was probably the background between what was happening. I do think Todd Huston recognizes that he's got to be a little more authoritative. He has a real easygoing style when he's up there, which is, great. But, just saying, let the speaker speak real kind of low isn't really getting the attention of his members. And so they were basically even ignoring his, wording during the event.
John Schwanes, I'm not going to put all of this certainly on Todd Huston, though he did express, regret for the role he's played in letting it get to this point. But frankly, if Brian Bosma were still the Speaker of the House, someone with 20 years experience in that job, 12 years experience in that job, had been leading the chamber, does this go differently?
Maybe. Certainly Brian Bosma was, after having been in that role for a long time and was very accustomed to herding the proverbial cats, was comfortable calling people on the carpet. So that's maybe not. I think, though, when we have that discussion, it probably shifts the attention and the blame, to the extent that there's blame here, away from the people on whom it should fall, and that's the people who were showing such disrespect for their colleagues. So I don't think I would take Todd Huston to task here as much as I would those members of the General Assembly who turned their backs on 200 years of tradition and decorum because this is a group, keep in mind that if you talk to lawmakers, they say, what's distinguishing about the General Assembly? They say it's not like Washington. Here we're adults, you know, we can work together, Republicans, Democrats. We're not like Washington. Well, be careful, because in some ways they are becoming like Washington.
Well, the House is only going to meet for very early in the week next week, as we've hit the halfway point of the session here next week. So it'll be interesting to see what the temperature in the room feels like. Well, Attorney General Todd Rokita has two jobs, as revealed by Importantville's Adam Wren this week, his state office, and as an advisor to a health benefits company he's been working for since 2019. Wren's story reveals that Rokita is still employed at Apex Benefits, advising the company and its clients on public policy initiatives and collaborating with industry experts on healthcare and benefits issues. The AG's office describes Rokita's work as limited and says he received an advisory opinion from the Indiana Inspector General that confirms the legality of holding both positions at the same time. Rokita and the Inspector General's office would not release that advisory opinion. Governor Eric Holcomb was asked about the situation at his weekly briefing.
I trust the Attorney General has followed the letter of the law.
The Indiana Democratic Party called for the advisory opinion to be released publicly. John Schwanes, if Rokita is following the law, is this a big deal?
We have to distinguish between the legalities here. And again, we won't really know that for sure until we actually do see the advisory opinion, which I think it is important that the public have an opportunity to see that and judge for itself. But in terms of the misconduct, if there is any, it's more a matter of optics and perception. You know, especially anybody in any government position, but one where you have the chief legal officer of the state who is charged with weighing in on legal matters and important matters before the state. And I think one matter that in all likelihood is front burner for Hoosiers and for the state of Indiana right now is health care and the provision of health care and how it's paid for. So, it maybe even makes it more problematic because of the subject matter. It'd be almost as if he were advising a private prison operator or something that, does this kind of business on a regular basis with the state of Indiana. So it seems more problematic from a perception standpoint.
Mike O'Brien, let's say everything Todd Rokita is doing is legal, which is what we've been told is the case. Does that make it okay?
Well, no, I don't think it does in this case. I don't think in politics in general, you want to live in a space where you've got to say what I did was legal. I mean, it's a bad position to be in if you're a statewide elected official. I think we've seen we have a legislature that is made up of, it's a citizen legislature, right? Unless you're retired, everybody's got a job and a career in a place that oftentimes overlaps with whatever they're working on a regular basis. I think these statewide elected officials, I think, are a little different. I mean, if this were the governor having another job, we'd ask a lot more questions, and we should, about what he was doing, whether or not it was considered legal. But again, that's just not a place you want to be when you're elected official saying everything I'm doing is legal.
And Delaney, are Hoosiers going to be okay with this?
I don't think so. I mean, he ran for this office knowing what it paid, and I don't remember any discussion during the campaign about him holding a second job. I don't know what Apex does. I don't know whether it does business with the state. I don't know whether it takes positions on health care. And the fact that he's not releasing this advisory opinion speaks volumes. I don't have any confidence in it. And even if it is, as Mike says, strictly legal, it stinks. Because we don't know what positions Apex is advocating, what they're lobbying for, and whether he's going to bring – he has the ability to bring lawsuits on anything. How do we know it's not something that Apex wants as opposed to what the citizens of Indiana want? We don't know that because we don't even know what they do, nor do we know what he's being compensated. I think it's absolutely outrageous.
All right. Well, speaking of statewide office holders, Indiana will soon have a new Secretary of State after Connie Lawson announced this week she is resigning her post. Lawson, who is 71, says she's stepping down to focus on her health and her family. In a statement, the Republican said, like many Hoosiers, 2020 took a toll on me. Lawson is the longest-serving Secretary of State in Indiana's history. That's because she was appointed to the role by Governor Mitch Daniels in 2012 after then-Secretary Charlie White was convicted of voter fraud. She was then re-elected in 2014 and 2018. Governor Eric Holcomb will appoint a replacement. Lawson says she'll officially step down once her successor has been identified. That person will serve out the rest of her term through the end of next year. Hoosiers will elect a new Secretary of State in the 2022 general election. Lawson, term limited, would not have been able to run again. Nikki Kelly, what are we hearing on potential replacements for Connie Lawson?
A few names here, and then one of the ones that has come up more often than others is Representative Holly Sullivan. I did chat with her this week, and she sort of wanted to give it a few days to review and before she makes a decision. I do think it's important to note that there is no specific health issue with Connie Lawson. I think it was just sort of, you know, at some point you're just ready to retire and enjoy the fruits of your labor, and it was a grueling election year, and it seems like a good time.
Yeah. Ann Delaney, it seems impossible to take the politics out of this. Whoever Eric Holcomb appoints, if they presumably want to run for that office when it's up for election next year, is giving them a big boost to essentially run as an incumbent. So how much will the politics play into this?
Oh, it always plays into it. When you elect a Republican to statewide office in Indiana, you get a pig in a poke because they never serve out their full terms. Am I right? I mean, they just simply don't. And they appoint people there so that they can continue. It's kind of like, you know, the birthright with kings. They think that they can, you know, just will the office down to the next one on the line. I would point out that Connie Lawson's had a lot of years of distinguished service. It would have been nice if she'd done more to make elections easier for voters, but she's entitled to retire. But she knew her age and all and how long the term lasted when she ran the last time, and she ran anyway. So, I mean, this is a pattern. It goes on so often, it's almost not. That's why I say it doesn't matter what name is on the ballot. That person won't serve a full-year term.
Mike O'Brien, Governor Holcomb's statement congratulating Lawson on her retirement. I mean, anytime certainly someone of the same party, even let alone another party, it's always pretty good. But this was more glowing than usual.
Well, she's got a pretty distinguished career in government service. Started as a county clerk and ended as Secretary of State with a long Senate career between those two places. Was incredibly well qualified to be Secretary of State. I think to Ann's point, you know, a lot of times one person moves and it causes a ripple effect. So if Holly Sullivan gets elected, well, now we have a vacancy somewhere else.
Yeah.
Right in a Evansville state rep seat, right? So then a lot of times it's just dominoes fall. And 2016 was the biggest example of that, obviously, with Sue Elserman stepping down. I think we had three auditors that year. It was a lot.
Yeah. It was a lot. But, yeah,
that's true. Mike Pence gets picked up and I need a new governor. Lieutenant governor becomes a governor. Uh-huh. Now you need a lieutenant governor candidate. It goes that one position can move a lot of them. I was a county chairman. That happened all the time, where you have one person have a job opportunity or something. So there's something conspiratorial here. It's just sometimes it's just practically how it plays out. We got a long bench and a lot of people we got to consider. Uh-huh.
All right. Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb signed into law this week legislation giving businesses and institutions broad liability protections for most COVID-19 lawsuits. The measure requires someone who wants to sue to show evidence of gross negligence or willful or wanton misconduct. In a statement, Holcomb said the legislation will prevent frivolous lawsuits and help aid the state's recovery from the pandemic. He says he believes most Hoosier businesses and organizations have been doing the best they can to protect their employees and customers. The bill raised concerns by some that it will give too much protection to long-term care providers and prevent families from suing nursing homes for the treatment of their loved ones during the pandemic. The law will be retroactive, effective the beginning of March of last year and continuing through 2024. Ann Delaney, we've talked before about the importance of balance to this bill. Does it strike the right balance?
It has no balance. I mean, we don't know what happened in the nursing homes. We know Indiana's nursing homes are understaffed, and we know the staff is underpaid. We know that. Okay, COVID, no COVID. We know that. Instead of having investigations as to what went wrong and what we could do better for the future, the legislature's not doing it. The governor's not doing it. The only way we had to look at this was through litigation. And now, even if it was gross incompetence, completely unrelated to COVID, the defense is going to be, it was during the period of time of COVID, so therefore we're immune. I think it's outrageous. They're already covered by the Malpractice Act. They already have degrees of protection that are there. And there are too many degrees of protection. And we're never going to know whether our nursing homes continue to be substandard or not under this bill. And that's exactly what the legislature wants.
Well, that will probably be something that the legislature continues to discuss for the rest of this session. But unfortunately, that is the final word for this week on Indiana Week in Review. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR. Or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Stay safe, stay healthy, please wear a mask, and join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.